I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW. The FDA has just approved injecting lunch meats with viruses. Freaked out? Stay tuned to manage your anxiety. Speaking of lunch meat, a little cured meats and cheeses can make what the Italians call antipasti. I'll get your mouth watering. Also, the best wines under $15. But first, let's get to the farmer's market to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's time of year to start looking at the pear crop that's just coming out, and California has a very small pear crop. We don't know why, but we are talking now with Mike Cerrone, who's the farmer from Sea Canyon, who brings us the Blenheim apricots. Now he's into his apples and his pears. Mike, you have been really doing a lot with pears. You want to tell us what you've got on your table this year, and kind of tell us more about the whole pear program you got?
I have Seckel pear, I have Red Bartlett, regular Bartlett, and a variety, for lack of a better name, we're calling Comis. We lost the tags when we planted, but they're really good. And
Let's describe what a Comis looks like and then what a Seckel looks like.
Well, the Comis that we have on our table is more of a greener pear. The real, true Comis are more russety. The Seckel, on the other hand, is a very small pear, almost roundish. And it has a distinct bronzing on it, like a bronze blush, that as it ripens becomes maroon. And then the underlying color will become almost golden.
And the Seckel pear is an amazing, amazing pear. And let's describe the texture now. A lot of people think Bartlett pears are grainy, and they don't like them.
Well, the main consideration with pears is to have them pre-ripened at the market. So when people get them, they know they can eat them. They're kind of like an avocado. If you bring a hard avocado to a farmer's market, you won't sell it. Same with the pear. We pre-ripen them for the most part. Or we get them real close, and we'll give you the full explanation, because pears need to come with an instruction manual.
Okay.
Because if you eat a pear when it's grainy, it's really not that great of an experience. Now, some people like them like that, but that's a very small percentage.
Do they get less grainy as they get riper?
Definitely. They switch over. They get a more kind of silky, creamy texture. I mean, and of course, we dry farm our pears, too, so the dry farm pear is really a different beast than the kind of heavily irrigated, heavily fertilized commercial type of pear that we run into at the store.
Right, and dry farming means what exactly?
Rainfall only. We are non-irrigated, and we are very fortunate. Sea Canyon is known as a dry farming area. They're rare in California. It's a coastal canyon with some really good underground water.
Mm-hmm.
We are blessed with rain.
And that just soaks into the ground and stays, and the roots keep tapping into that.
We have very steep canyon walls that kind of drain, and the drainage comes underneath the orchards.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is because you're dry farmed, I have a lot of comments from customers. There's something about your avocados that they just don't taste like everybody else's avocados.
Well, that doesn't have anything to do with dry farming, because the Hass avocados are not dry farmed. You have to grow them with water. But avocados from San Luis Obispo County, and they're not just mine, everybody's, have a higher oil content because they hang on the tree longer. We are a very cool growing district. Our fruit's on the tree for 18 months, sometimes up to 2 years. So the oil contents go way, way up. And that's what you're dealing with, very high oil content. They're extremely rich.
All right, Mike. Well, we're so glad you're here. And I have tried the avocados. They really are special, and I'm very excited about all the little pears you have, too. So thanks for doing such a great job.
Well, thank you.
That was Mike Cerrone, and he's growing some pears up in Sea Canyon, and he's described the flavor, and he's also described his avocados, but you got to come and taste them. He's here at the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica markets. We're visiting now with Sophia, who is a grower of dates. It comes out from Thermal, California. There's only a few areas in California where dates will grow. Thermal is one of them. Her boss is Robert Lauer from Flying Disc. Robert's been at the Wednesday Santa Monica Market for all 25 years. Now, Sophia, this is what I'm excited about. You got the fresh Barhi dates. That's because it's September. Can you describe those and try to tell us what they taste like?
Well, they're a Middle Eastern delicacy. And the way that we describe their taste is we say that it's a mix of sugarcane, coconut, and a little bit of astringency like a persimmon. They're very, very, very sweet.
And they're bright, well, they're kind of a dull yellow gold, and you have them on the stem, so they're beautiful. And then you have a few, as they start to soften and turn into a ripe barhi, they get soft and like spun sugar.
But, you know, I mean, they're just, they're amazing. And it's this huge, big tradition down in the valley because you have all of these farmers out in the fields cutting these strands,
right.
You know, and it's like this mad dash hustle. It's
now, you bring them to farmers markets, but is there a commercial market for those?
There is a huge commercial market. It's spread all across the United States. We're talking about 31 growers supplying dates to the entire United States and some overseas.
For a very short time because these are just getting ripe every day.
Yeah.
It's just a very concentrated, very small industry out there in the desert. And you've been picking, and how hot is it out there in thermal?
It's like, I don't know, the other day it reached maybe 116.
Yeah,
but it's, you know, it's good. It makes you feel good. And
thanks so much, Sophia.
Oh, well, thank you, Laura. It's nice to see you.
Good to talk to you, too. That was Sophia. She's in here for Robert Lauer's Flying Disc Ranch. You can tell Robert's a Frisbee fan. And these are the dates, and I'm very fascinated, too, that Robert does have his one special brand, the Cire, which probably you can't get anywhere else. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Sliced bologna, turkey, hot dogs. These kinds of lunch meats make it into thousands of children's lunch boxes every day. So how would you feel about food manufacturers spraying viruses onto these same cold cuts? The FDA just approved bacteria-eating viruses as the latest food additive. I'll tell you more next when Good Food returns. As our society becomes more technologically sophisticated and science takes leaps ahead, expect our food to get weirder and weirder. The latest, quote, leap forward, unquote, is spraying viruses on meat to protect us. Yes, you heard right, that's to protect us. With us today to sort through microphage on meat is Will Clower, our neuroscience historian who keeps us up to date on the intersection between science and food. Dr. Will Clower is the author of The Fat Fallacy and The French Don't Diet Plan. Well, Will, what do you think about this latest weirdness?
Yeah, it's kind of odd, isn't it? The ode to virus, putting that on your food. You know what it is that there's a small chance that through the process of meat processing for cold cuts, bologna, hot dogs, things like that, that you could get listeria.
And what is listeria?
It's a bacteria that's found in the soil. And in these processing plants, because they're not perfectly clean, they can get that introduced into the products. You know what the incidence of that is?
What?
It's like nothing. It's like 99.999% likelihood that you won't get it. You know, it's like 2,500 people a year.
But those 2,500 people, do they die? Do they get really sick? What happens?
Yeah, they get sick. And, you know, you have neck pain, you have a fever. A portion of them can die if it goes to an extent. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where the percentage of getting E. coli is very, you know, it's like 20 times higher, but nobody's saying anything about hamburgers. It's funny. You know, and this, what's funny too, Evan, is that do you remember when they were banning the importation of raw milk cheese to the U.S.?
Yes.
It was for the same reason. They pointed to the same thing, listeria, but the chances of getting listeria are so small that it's kind of a non-issue. So it's funny to me when I read this report that the FDA just passed this cocktail of six live viruses that they're going to be putting on processed meats, cold cuts, and hot dogs. The thing that struck me, and the thing that was a little disturbing behind the science, actually, is that they're not going to let you know which one of your hot dogs was sprayed with this and which one wasn't.
Okay, let's get into this a little deeper so all of us understand better. What effect do the viruses have on preventing listeriosis?
Well, what they'll do is they'll grow these viruses, these bacteriophages, in the presence of the offending bacteria so that they're specific for it. And then once they have a group of bacteriophages, they can apply it to the product and they will attack that particular cell.
So it's a really, really specific listeria-eating cocktail of viruses.
Exactly.
The ick factor for this is so high.
It's off the charts.
As I understand from what I've read, all of this was initiated by the company which grows the viruses.
That's right. That's right. And people looked at using the bacteriophages in a number of different ways. Like, gosh, back in the 30s and 40s, and we abandoned it a long time ago. I mean, they kept doing it in the Soviet Union and all, but we haven't used phage therapy for treating bacterial infection in probably 60 or 70 years.
But I understand that they're starting to think about it again since so many bacteria are becoming resistant to antibiotics.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. The best use of this is with direct application. So like if you have an infection on your hand, for example, applying it directly to it is the best way to apply this. What happens when it's systemic is another thing altogether. It's not clear what happens then.
And do we know how widely it's being embraced by the processed meat industry?
It's so brand new. It is so brand new that it's not clear yet. This was the first introduction, and it just really caused a huge stir because of this whole ick factor thing.
And the no labeling thing mixed
and
together.
And the no labeling. Oh, my gosh. It's like GMO foods. You know, you have no idea which corn is genetically modified and which is not, and tomatoes and stuff. And those are the kind of issues that when I see my people getting back in touch with me, that's the thing that they say, gosh, just let me have a choice.
Do you think that these applications that we're talking about now in the food industry are going to lead to a renewed interest in using these phages for antibacterial purposes with people?
Oh, absolutely. I do. Just because, especially outside the body, they're very, very specific. And so you can tailor them to one particular kind of bacteria. And in fact, they're so specific that some people have listed that as a disadvantage because a lot of infections that people have will be from a number of bacteria. And so if your phage only attacks one kind, then that's why you need this cocktail. That's why they're having this spray that is consisting of six live viruses.
Very, very, very strange.
Yeah, yeah, it is weird. It is weird. On my food, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for sharing in this moment of super ick.
Yeah.
Take care, Will.
You bet. Thank you.
Will Clower is a neuroscience historian. He's written two interesting books on eating. The most recent is The French Don't Diet. In the old country, people thought that a glass of alcohol could kill anything that was trying to kill you. I'm not sure if that works, but it's a good excuse to drink a glass of wine now and then. Next, I'll talk with the founder of a unique wine marketplace that brings small producers to a large audience. That's coming up on Good Food. Two best friends from the frozen tundra are overwhelmed by the sheer selection of wines out there in the marketplace. Yet they're underwhelmed by the brands available in local stores. they set out to discover small winemakers making the most amazing wines that nobody knows about and offer just one very select offering per day on the web direct to your home from the winery. RadCrew.com is born. One of those friends from the frozen tundra is with us this morning. Meet Jeff Plater. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Evan. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
So why don't you describe exactly what RadCrew is?
RadCrew is a winery direct marketplace. We work with a couple hundred different wineries right now. We offer one very select hand-picked wine direct from the winery to our consumer.
Now, it's kind of sounds like a dating service for customers and wineries.
Very, very similar. My partner and I were just kind of overwhelmed by the sheer choices that were out there. But yet, as I said, as you said, a little underwhelmed by some of the quality issues. And we knew that there were just amazing small brands out there that are making, you know, under 1,000 cases of a wine that they don't necessarily have the distribution throughout the whole U.S. They don't have maybe some of the marketing skills that we have, hopefully, and are just kind of lost in the clutter. So we wanted to go out and find them, and we have.
Now, how do you curate the selection of wines and wineries?
Right now, what we've been doing is, in the lead-up to launching, we've been in business now for 3 weeks. We've been meeting with winemakers. We've been going out to Napa and surrounding wine areas and meeting with them and actually tasting their wines and talking to them about pricing and talking to them about some of the wines that they're really interested in that they can geek out on, essentially, and going and trying to feature those.
Now, if I'm a consumer and I go on to radcrew.com, RADCRU.com, what do I see?
You are going to be inundated with just one wine. It's pretty simple. You go to the website and we have an image of the wine that we're featuring for that day. Then we try to go and provide as much information about it as possible, all the way down to the technical notes that wine lovers maybe not really realizing is there, but down to the alcohol content, the manufacturing process, which vineyard the grapes came from, all of those types of really kind of nerdy, geeky things that people maybe don't really get when they go to a traditional wine shop.
Now, you've been open only 3 weeks. Have you had a chance yet for consumers to start receiving their wines from the wineries and start to give you feedback?
Absolutely. What's fantastic about it is the wineries are the ones that are shipping the product. They're already built and have essentially cellar door shipping abilities, so they can process the order very rapidly. And some of the shipping options that we have, we've been trying to offer either very greatly discounted shipping rates or free shipping on a lot of the orders that we've had. So you're getting the wine within 2 to 3 days of actually placing it.
Now, I noticed I went onto the site for the first time yesterday, and I noticed a $60 bottle of wine. And then today, I noticed that the wine is an $18 bottle of wine.
Right. We're kind of all over the spectrum. We want to go out and make sure that we have some wines that are able to really move by volume if they're, you know, at a mid-tier price like $18 to $24 or something around that. But we also want to go out and we're getting approached with wines that are really, really big, great wines, and they're just a little bit more of a price point. So we want to try and offer a little bit more broader selection in the pricing and the collectability maybe of the wines.
Have you heard from wineries with what kind of feedback they're getting from the consumer? Have people already started pulling corks?
Absolutely. I think what we've been finding out is that they've been really busy processing orders. So I think they're pretty happy with what's been happening so far.
It's very, very interesting. I mean, I know that I'm the kind of person that when I go into any kind of store, I get really easily overwhelmed by a lot of choice. Like, I'm one of those kind of people that I could spend an hour in the cereal aisle and then walk out of the store with no cereal.
Absolutely. This is really simple. We're just trying to kind of break through the clutter, find something that we like, that we think a lot of people will like, and feature it every day. What we would really love to have is people to come in, check out radcrew.com first thing in the morning. They may like the wine. They may not like the wine. Come back tomorrow. It's going to be something different.
What a great idea. Well, more power to you and your partner, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That was Jeff Plater. He's one of the partners in a new wine marketing site called Rad Crew. That's RADCRU.com. If buying wine online isn't your game, you can always walk into a solid local wine shop. In it, you'll usually find a few knowledgeable and passionate people ready to tell you about their new finds. I've got one of those passionate people here with me next. She's got some wines not to miss under $15. Is it that time of the month when you want to pleasure yourself with a grape, but you don't have quite the money that you usually spend on wine? Here with me today to talk about some great wine selections under $10 is Stacy Hunt, our favorite wine guru from Duvan Wine and Spirits.
Hi, Evan. I call this the under 10 doo-wop because there are so many really terrific wines, and they are under $10. I would say that, for instance, in our shop, 60% of our wines are under 20. 60%. So that gives you an idea of what people are drinking and how much good wine there is for great value. Not necessarily are you going to find it as California wine from Napa Valley, but that's all right. There are some extraordinary wine regions around the world, in Spain, in Italy, in France, in Chile, Argentina. And the wine coming out of there is, oh, and also, of course, Australia, is really delicious, well-made, and the most important thing I would say about it, it is true to the grape varietal.
How is it possible that some wines actually can be produced for such a small amount of money? Is it that each of these wines is produced in great quantity, or is it that the winemaker is trying to break into a market, a world market, and in the hope that they'll be discovered, they sort of underprice themselves?
Well, there's a couple of things. Some of these wines that we're going to talk about do have large production, but nowhere near as large as some of the California wineries, and yet they're still less expensive. Number two, many of them have government subsidy and government support, which we don't have in the United States. Number three, they don't have OSHA. And OSHA, as you know, is the bane of anybody in the that owns a business. And OSHA requires so many things and so much paperwork and all of this.
In terms of oversight for worker safety.
Oversight for worker safety. And I think the United States is just a much more expensive place in the world to produce anything. Also, the dollar is, you know, in not doing so well against some of these other, against the euro and especially the pound. Not that we have wine out of UK today, but the idea being that, you know, there is a better value to be had by buying wines from another country.
Okay, let's take a look.
Okay, I'd like to start with rosé because, you know, rosé season is in full swing. So the three rosés I'm going to talk about, not surprisingly, come from Provence, which is the home and the motherland of rosé. And the first one is called Arnavé. It's $9.99. The vineyards are very close to an entire lavender field. Ooh. And the lavender field is used to make cosmetics and fragrance additions. So this wine, I believe you can just tell when you're drinking it that there is a hint of lavender in it. And this is not surprising because, you know, there is only one ground and here are two roots, the grape root and the lavender root, both sucking nutrients from the same ground. So they probably interchange a little bit of their stuff, their essence. The next one is the most famous rosé probably in the world. It's called Saint-Tropez. It's in a bottle that's kind of shaped like a woman's body, you know, the 36-22-36 shape. And it's got a blue label on it. It is the wine of the Cannes Film Festival. It is called Saint-Tropez Rosé, and it is $8.99 a bottle. And this is just a beautiful salmon-colored rosé that just goes well with everything. And then there's a new kid on the block coming from Provence, and it's a Bandol Rosé. Bandol being, I guess you would say, the champagne of rosés. And this one is called something very un-French, R-N, the initials, 13. So clearly,
sounds like a sushi bar downtown.
Sounds like a sushi bar downtown. Sounds like probably the winemaker or the producer spent a little time in California. But this one is $10.99, slightly going over my doo-wop number, but nonetheless, one if you feel like having the champagne of rosés.
Okay, now let's go to whites.
Okay, white. The white wines are very interesting. We have coming from Bordeaux. And Bordeaux, we primarily think of as a red wine, the big, full red wine region. Well, they also make in an area of Entre-deux-Mers, they make a beautiful white wine, and the grape is Semillon. And Landerot is the producer. The wine is fresh, it's dry, and when you drink it, it kind of fills your mouth up with a nice minerally white taste, and then as you swallow, you have this nice dryness. This goes very well with any foods that might be what I would call creamy, like an oyster, like shrimp, creamy cheeses. You know, this is perfect for that. It just cuts through all of that. And this wine, you know, weighs in at $9.99 a bottle. And then I do have another one that I want to throw in there, and this is one from Spain. It comes from Rueda. Rueda is in the northwestern part of Spain, the primary white area for Spanish wine. And this is a Verdejo grape. And this one has a little spice, a little kick. So it would be very good with either Asian food, Italian food, you know, salamis, salty food, prosciutto.
It can hold itself
up. It can hold itself up. And this one weighs in at $8.99.
And now let's go to red.
Okay. Believe it or not, the red wines are kind of exciting because we've got some rich, robust stuff happening here. If Provence is the home for the most gentle feminine rosés in the world, it is also the home for the blackest, deepest, richest reds. And there is a red wine I'm going to talk about from Provence, and it's called Chateau Bas, B-A-S. And it combines three or four of the local grapes there, and the color in the bottle is like almost black.
Is it the kind of wine that turns your teeth purple?
No, that would be Grenache. You know, no, this doesn't turn your teeth purple, but this turns your heart on, I'll tell you. I mean, you drink this wine with a barbecue or, you know, with a steak, and, you know, it is just, boy, the switch goes on. It is great. And that one, by the way, is $8.99. I mean, imagine that you could get this rich red wine for that price. Another one is a surprise. Comes from California. It's a blend of Syrah, Grenache, and Mourvèdre. And this wine, again, very rich, but very, very fruity. And it will compete with that Provence wine for a barbecue or a steak, but it's also quite beautiful with a roast chicken or with a seared tuna. And this one is, and hold on to your seats, $7.99.
Incredible.
From Santa Barbara.
Incredible.
And the last on my list is a Buisset, and this comes from the Languedoc area of France. And this will have probably a medium weight to it. And you will find this wine weighing at $7.99. And it would be perfect with a summer meal.
Stacy, thank you once again.
Thanks, Devin.
You can find Stacy Hunt and the wine she mentioned at Duvin Wine and Spirits. They're on Melrose, just below San Vicente in West Hollywood. You know, I can't think of a better way to drink wine than to have something to eat with it. The Italians know all about this way to eat. They have a whole world of dishes known as antipasti, or small plates. More to make your mouth water next. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. I suppose that the first part of the Italian table to grab me completely in my initial seduction to the cuisine was, appropriately enough, antipasti, that eclectic introduction to the meal that over the years has quite literally become the meal for me. That moment of walking into an Italian restaurant to be greeted by a sideboard filled with plates of tasty treats never fails to fill me with anticipation. So when I received Joyce Goldstein's latest effort, titled Antipasti, I felt that same sense of delight and impending satisfaction as I started to leaf through the book. Hello, Miss Goldstein.
Ciao, Evan. Come stai?
Bene, bene. So what role do antipasti have in a traditional Italian meal?
Well, it used to be the course that you had before you sat down to have your pasta and whatever else you were going to eat. And I, too, was seduced when I walked into Italian restaurants and saw this table of food. I thought, that's a meal for me. I can just fill up on that and be really, really happy. But it is usually sort of the course before a formal meal. Now, I don't know how many people are really still eating these big formal meals. I think life has changed so much in Italy and here that if someone presented you with a table of antipasti, you'd probably walk down with your plate, select a bunch of goodies, and that would be dinner.
I think antipasti in many people's minds means a giant plate of salami, cheese, and olives.
All drowning in vinaigrette and ruining the meat.
Of course.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I don't think many people have experienced this incredible credenza filled with beautiful plates of salads and olives and marinated fish and stuffed eggplant and all of these incredible dishes that, sort of are enough. That's the way I look at it, enough.
What would be on a very standard Roman credenza 20 years ago, and what do you think would be happening now? Take us through a little bit of the changes of what some of these dishes are.
I think the major change has not happened at the credenza, but happens a la minute at the table. It used to be that antipasti were all room temperature dishes prepared ahead of time and mellowed out and served on the table. A lot of those dishes are still in the pipeline. I mean, you can still get beautifully marinated anchovies and marinated balls of mozzarella and eggplant salads and seafood and a wonderful vinaigrette. All of those dishes are still there. But what happened is that a bunch of these Italian chefs went to France, did a stage, came back, discovered that they could do last-minute composed salad or play with, texture, serve a warm bean salad or some sautéed shrimp on top of room-temperature beans, or take dishes that they had had before as a primo, like a sformato, which little steamed custard, could be vegetables, could be cheese. Those used to be listed in the primo category, and all of a sudden they've moved on to the antipasto menu. So the big change is that a lot of dishes are now individual plates rather than served from communal platters, and that some of them are warm. And some of them are even green salads with condiments like crispy prosciutto or sautéed mushrooms, things that the Italians never had on the antipasto table before.
Now, what about some really traditional old-line dishes that we normally think of as main courses, things like vitello tonnato, the veal in tuna sauce? Can that be turned into an antipasti?
I don't see why not. I mean, it is a room temperature first course. You do make this very succulent, sexy tuna mayonnaise, and you put it on slices of cold veal. You could actually put it on the same tuna mayonnaise, would be lovely on just some leftover roast chicken. It's also spectacular on roasted red peppers and on slices of tomato. Once you've made tuna mayonnaise, you can sort of go crazy and put it on a lot of different things.
Now, give us some ideas for some fish or seafood antipasti.
Well, right now in the Bay Area, last week I got some beautiful scallops and beautiful small baby squid. And so I did a squid and artichoke salad where I, quickly cooked the squid, like for 2 seconds, and cleaned the artichokes and sautéed them and put them together in a very lively mint vinaigrette, which was just great. Any kind of sautéed or steamed shellfish is perfect on a white bean salad because most people expect to get tuna. So by adding shellfish to that, you've made a slightly sexier dish.
Now, in your role these days as a restaurant consultant and working on so many recipes as you do, you're constantly eating new foods. But are there things in this category that are comfort foods for you that you manage to fit into your cooking schedule, even though for work you may have to make many, many new dishes?
I'm an old traditionalist, so I don't want to give up my old favorites. I mean, these are certain things that are important to me. That white bean salad is important to me, and I like it with tuna, either fresh or canned, and shaved red onions, but I'm willing to fool around with it and serve warm squid in a lively dressing on it. I still like the one with the tuna. It's still one of the things that's important to me. Chicken liver crostini, gotta have it. I've been eating chicken liver crostini since I landed in Italy in, what, the 50s. It's one of the great important dishes for me, and it's a dish that I don't want to change, and I don't want to put foam on it or do anything weird to it. It's just a classic dish. The little rice croquettes that, you know, I've been eating for years, the souffle, the ones that are stuffed with cheese and sometimes prosciutto, that's a classic dish. There's no need to mess around with it.
Joyce, you're so much fun to talk to. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Evan. Let's have dinner.
I'd love to. I'm hungry now.
Good.
Joyce Goldstein is the author of many books. Her most recent is Antipasti, and it's definitely worth owning. Even though summer's nearly over, it's never time to stop marinating. Here's a quick tip for some tasty results. Jim Tarantino's here to give us some ideas for some great glazes for finishing our food. His book is Marinades, Ribs, Brines, Cures, and Glazes. So glazes add that beautiful finishing touch and give us that pop of flavor, don't they?
They certainly do. It's a real culinary shellacking.
I love that way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your favorite ingredients for setting up a glaze?
I have one particular glaze that I like a lot. It's a three-ingredient wonder, and these are my favorite kind of glazes. It's a maple pomegranate glaze, includes a half a cup of maple syrup, pomegranate molasses, and extra virgin olive oil. Now, that particular glaze can go on salmon, chicken, Cornish hens, and work just fine. But it's so flexible, you can roll things into it, such as toasted coconut, or I would say even diced jalapeno or even dried carrot for different types of effect. It's a wonderful little glaze that can be applied 5 minutes at the end of the cooking session.
Now for glazes, are we always talking about an application that's after we finish cooking or right at the end?
Yes, we are. There's an issue about grilling or cooking something glaze side down. What will happen with that is you create a caramelization effect. In other words, it will burn and taste that way.
Give us another glaze idea.
Here's one. It's a carrot, curry, caramel. And that's involved by using sugar and water and light corn syrup and creating your base camp caramel. And then adding 2 cups of carrot juice, a teaspoon of curry, a teaspoon of vanilla, and 2 tablespoons of soy. And starting a slight reduction. Those flavors are unreal.
What do you like to use that on? Is that good for pork?
I like it on white meat as well as shellfish.
So are we pretty much always adding these glazes in the last 5 minutes of cooking?
Absolutely. Now, the only difference that you would be doing that would be, let's say, for example, if you're going to glaze a ham. If you're doing low and slow, then you can actually apply glaze during the last half hour.
What great tips. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you very much.
That was Jim Tarantino giving us a few hints for glazes for finishing our food. His book is Marinades, Rubs, Brines, Cures, and Glazes. I think it's about time for dessert. And I'm not talking about cakes or brownies. My mom and all my good friends know that when my birthday comes around, I'm all about fruit pies. The tarte tatin is the pie's delicate French cousin. I've got a baker to tell us the tale of the tarte. That's coming up on Good Food. When it happened that tarte tatin became my favorite dessert. I know that by the time I was 10 or 11, I'd convinced my mom to serve an apple pie instead of the traditional cake for my birthdays. Something about the yielding, slightly tart sweetness of cooked apples combined with the buttery, flaky crust grabbed a hold of me and wouldn't let go. So I guess it was kind of natural that as I became more food sophisticated, the tarte tatin would embrace me with its particular allure. Claudine Lamar and her partner, Dennis DeBust, are award-winning European chefs that own Artisan Tatin in Culver City. It's a French deli store and full-service catering company. One of their specialties at the restaurant, of course, is the tarte tatin. Claudine is with us this morning to explore this magnificent example of French baking. How nice to have you here.
Thank you.
So, Claudine, tell us a little bit about the history of the tarte tatin. How did it all begin?
It was more than one century. Two sisters had a restaurant in La Motte-Beuvron in Sologne in France. And they have like auberge, we call like that.
Like and, a little hotel, an inn.
Yeah. And they cook together. And one day, one of the sisters make a pie, but put in the oven on the right side and cook like that. And when she take out, she sees a pie, and she was very nice and caramelized. And she was very happy, and she discovered a new recipe. And after that, she makes this pie her specialty.
Was her name Tatin? Was that their last name?
Yes.
I think that must be the best, to have your name immortalized in something that's so delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Can you take us through? I know that I cook a lot, and every time I have to make a tarte tatin, or I decide I'm going to make a tarte tatin, I go through such anxiety that I'm going to do it wrong, that the apples are going to either be too mushy or too hard, that it's going to be too black, too caramelized, or not caramelized enough. So can you take us through a little bit the technique?
The technique is you should have a very heavy pan for that. Like in copper or something like that, you know. And first table, you should put very little butter. We call chemise.
Just to film the bottom.
With a paint or something like that, you know. Very, very little.
Very little. Yeah. So you do it with a pastry brush?
Yes. And you put also 2 tablespoons of sugar. And around the pan, and after that, you can put your apple.
What variety do you use?
In general, I'll use a Golden Delicious.
And why do you choose that particular variety?
Because they have all the quality for this kind of recipe. They stay firm, they are not too juicy, they are sweet. And they cook perfect. If you use another variety, many times they are too soft. They become puree. And it's no good for the look, for the tatin.
So after you peel the apple, do you slice them in half?
Half.
Vertically or horizontally?
No, vertically. Vertically. And take out the seed. And put, I don't know what you call that, like that.
You stack them next to each other.
Yeah.
Tight?
Yes.
And so really you're just adding like 2 tablespoons full of sugar.
No. This is only for the base.
Oh.
For the regular tatin, like for 8 or 10 people, you should use about 14 apple, 14 golden, mm-hmm. medium size, not too big, not too small. For that, you need 150 grams of sugar, 120 grams of butter. You slice very fine the butter, you put around and on top, and put on the stove.
So you started on the stove top.
Yeah, for 20 minutes.
Really, for 20 minutes? Yes. How high heat do you use?
Fast. They should cook fast. After that, you have a caramel. A little brown, not too black. You should see, you should stay in front of that. You can do anything else. Okay? And after that, you put in the oven, cook for about 15 minutes. You should roll the dough and take out after 15 minutes, put the dough on top, and you should...
crimp the pastry.
Yeah, thank you.
That's
crème, you know. I don't know. I know all the word in French, but
they're
in English...
They're probably much more beautiful than French.
I don't know. No, no. And with a fork...
You want to stab the dough.
Yeah, because if you don't do that, the puff pastry go up too much, you know.
I mm-hmm. should ask you, what temperature should the oven be?
350.
Oh, nice and moderate.
Yeah.
And so after the puff paste is golden, mm-hmm. then we pull it out.
Yeah.
Do we wait before
yes.
we turn it upside down?
Leave in a side. Wait 1 or 2 hours.
Really?
Become cold. And I put in a refrigerator. I make in the morning for the night. And before I serve it, I take out. I put on the stove for 5 minutes, only for warm, and turn up, and it's perfect.
It's been such a pleasure having you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Artisan Tintin is located on Washington Boulevard near Westwood. They have a French deli store and a full-service catering company. You can read more about them online at artisantatin, that's TATIN.com. Earlier in the program, I talked about wine. There's a big difference in what a good wine and a bad wine taste like. The flavors may be difficult for some to name, but you can identify distinct differences in taste. But what about water? Could you identify one brand of bottled water over another? My next guest can. He's like a water sommelier, and he's got flavor pairings for particular bottled waters. That's when Good Food continues. Happens when a wine connoisseur is told by his doctor that he has to choose between life and all those bottles in his cellar. In the case of Dr. Michael Masha, he made an interesting choice. He decided to forego the wine and embrace water, but not just any water. He's become a water connoisseur. His website, finewaters.com, introduces us to the nomenclature and etiquette of appreciating bottled waters. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What do you say to people who say that the differences in bottled water are so subtle as to be unimportant?
I think the differences are subtle, but if you start exploring and paying intelligent attention, you will discover there's a new world opening up, and the new world has a very wide range of flavors.
Now, I know that what was the impetus for you of exploring the world of water was having this whole avenue of connoisseurship and ritual closed to you, that of wine.
Exactly. It's like you're really focusing on wine and, you know, handling the wine is very important, you know, talking about the wine in an Epicurean context. And suddenly the thing is totally ripped out of your world and you're looking for replacement.
And did you have a particular experience in drinking water with food when you realized that this didn't have to be a sort of punitive thing, but it could be something that you embraced.
Absolutely. I still remember it was in a very fancy L.A. restaurant with a lot of friends, and they all drank wine, of course, and they had their wine in Riedel sommelier glasses. And I had my water, and the choice was only still a sparkling. I had my water in a tumbler. And then imagine the sound if you toast, and there's six Riedel glasses, and then there's your tumbler. It makes a very, very awful sound. And this was, for me, the epiphany, saying, you know, something needs to change.
Well, and I would imagine Southern California, maybe California in general, where people are so interested in health and being well hydrated, that it's a perfect place to begin to have the discussion about water in a more serious context.
Absolutely. But I think it's also really very important to point out that, in my opinion, there are two kinds of bottled water. There's the bottled water with the emphasis on the bottle. That's something you buy at the supermarket or at the airport. And it's usually tap water or municipal water is the source for the bottled water. So the emphasis is on the bottle. But there's another water where the emphasis is actually on the water, and the bottle is just a means of getting it to you. And this is the very fine, high-end waters you get from all over the world.
First of all, let's start maybe with sparkling water. Mm-hmm. Give us three types of sparkling bottled water which you feel really delineate three different flavor profiles or mouthfeels or whatever the nomenclature is that you use to describe water.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Basically, in the past, people thought it's still in sparkling, nothing else in between. But we've opened up the space a little bit and divided it into five sections, ranging from a still water, then to water which we call effervescent, with very small, very fine bubbles, almost indistinguishable. Then something we call light. Light water has some bubbles, but they're not as prominent. And then we have a classic section, which is usually what most people are used to, and a section with bold waters, which has very high bubbles. So think of the one extreme side being Perrier, for example. And if you know, if you drink Perrier, you have this very loud kind of firework in your mouth feeling.
And going down as it travels down your esophagus, you almost feel it burn.
And people say they don't like sparkling water because they think sparkling water is Perrier, the loud bubbles. And what I see sometimes in restaurants, people, especially from European descent, they take a spoon and stir a little bit the water to get the bubbles softer and smaller. So we really have, if we match water with food, which my site suggested and I'm suggesting, we really have to pay attention to the bubbles and the size of the bubbles.
So if we want something that isn't as hard a bubble as Perrier, but isn't completely light, what would we choose?
I mean, Ramlösa, for example, water from Sweden is a perfect example for the middle. It has about 5 milligrams of carbonation and kind of defines the middle. And on the lower end, most people are familiar with Badoit, water from France, you know, naturally carbonated, which has very, very fine and soft bubbles.
So what is the difference in mouthfeel between a water like Badoit, where you have a natural carbonation versus a carbonation that's been pumped into the water?
In the example for a Badoit, the natural carbonation comes from some volcanic activity below the aquifer, and CO2 seeps into the aquifer, and the water emerges naturally carbonated. Those things are very, very rare, and very few waters are naturally carbonated. Perrier is one of them. You know, most people are familiar with Apollinaris from Germany. Those kind of waters have natural carbonation.
Now, do you also on your site, do you talk about the different mineral contents of many of these waters that come from natural springs?
Mm-hmm. It's really important. Americans are usually used to waters with a very low mineral content, I would say around 50 to 100 milligrams per liter in mineral content. But some waters in Europe have, you know, 1,000, 1,500 or up to 3,000 milligrams per liter TDS, total dissolved solids, so very substantial waters.
And what does this do to the flavor, this additional mineral content?
It makes it more profound. If you want to compare it to wine, a low TDS would be the white wine, and a higher TDS, especially above 1,000, would be the kind of the red wine.
Now let's talk a little bit about the nomenclature that you use to describe water. First, give us some flavor nomenclature, and then some mouthfeel, because I would imagine that with water, the mouthfeel is one of the most important things.
You're absolutely right. Mouthfeel is the most important thing. And it's really interesting. So if you look at flavor is actually not a property of the water itself. Flavor is something that gets computed in our brains based on inputs from our taste. This is the taste bud on the tongues, and from our smell. And additionally to that, there's mouthfeel. So the flavor is a combination of all of those things calculated in our brain.
So what do you call different mouthfeels? Like, is there a soft water and a more, I don't want to say viscous because you don't want viscous water either.
The most important factor is that when you match water with food, that the mouthfeel matches the preparation of the food. Let me give you some example. If you have sushi or sashimi, you know, very, very subtle tastes, and now imagine drinking a glass of Perrier with that. It wouldn't work. You know, the subtleness of the fish would be destroyed by the fire in your mouth or the mouthfeel from Perrier. But now think drinking some still water, especially some low TDS, low mineral still water with a sushi works much better. The other way around, imagine a crispy fried oyster, really crispy on the outside. Now, if you pair this with a Perrier, it works very nicely because the mouthfeel complement things.
Give us an example of a couple of still waters that represent a different sort of experience.
Again, with still water, in the absence of the bubbles, now the minerality or the mineral content of the water becomes very important. And again, we have a very wide range here. We have, for example, from Italy, from high of the Italian mountains, Loretana, which is a very, very low TDS. So it's a very clean, soft feeling. Even further extreme down that road is rainwater from Tasmania. We have now rainwater from Tasmania being bottled and available in the U.S.
What is it called?
It's called Tasmanian rain, which I would suggest if you make ice cubes. I usually use it at home to making ice cubes if you make martinis or other cocktails. You don't want to use your tap water, right?
Amazing.
I think it's really important to not consider water a commodity that comes out of the tap. Consider where it's coming from.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Absolutely.
I've been speaking with Dr. Michael Masha. He has a book that's going to be coming out soon called Fine Waters, and he has a website, finewaters.com, where you can learn all you ever wanted to know about fine bottled water.
Good Food is podcast each week and available to listen to anytime at kcrw.com. The executive producers, Jennifer Farrow, Marina McLeod, Candace Moyer, Thea Challoner, and Priya Fenimore produce this program. Thanks to Reed Rudy for voice work and to Gary Masiha for selecting the music in the show. I'm Evan Kleinman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.